for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and I know this band has played out, but I like this song, so what the hell.
The sisters are in to check the front line. Seems I spent the 80s in a Haiti state of mind. Cast me in the practice for electric shock. Straight incarcerated, the curriculum to sell block. I'm swimming in half truths and they make me wanna spit. Struck the curse, separate the healthy from the sick.
Welcome to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This just in from The Onion via LouRockwell.com. Study: Iraqis may experience sadness when friends, relatives die. Chapel Hill, North Carolina. A field study released Monday by the University of North Carolina School of Public Health suggests that Iraqi citizens experience sadness and a sense of loss when relatives, spouses, and even friends perish. Emotions that have until recently been identified almost exclusively with Westerners. Quote, "We were struck by how an Iraqi reacts to the sight of a bloody or decapitated corpse of a family member. It's not unlike an American, or at least the way a Canadian would. said Jonathan Pritzel, chief author of the study. In addition to the rage, bloodlust, and hatred we already know to dominate the Iraqi emotional spectrum, it appears that they may have some capacity, however limited, for sadness. Though Pritzel was quick to add that that more detailed analysis is needed, he said the findings cast some doubt on long-held assumptions about human nature in that region. Contrary to conventional wisdom, it seems that Iraqis do indeed experience at least minor feelings of grief when a best friend or grandparent is ripped apart by a car bomb or shot execution style and later unearthed in a shallow mass grave, Pritzel said. Last December's suicide bomb killing of 71 Shiites in Baghdad, for example, produced unexpected reactions ranging from crumpled, sobbing despair to silent, dazed shock. Iraqis have often been observed weeping and wailing in apparent anguish, but the study offers evidence indicating that this may not be exclusively an outward expression of anger or a desire for revenge. It also provocatively suggests that this grief can possess an American-like personal quality. It is not simply a tribal lamentation ritual. Said Pritzel, we're trying to understand the psychology of the Iraqi citizenry after 4 years of war. Think of a small American town roiled by the death of a well-known high school football player. According to Pritzel, the intensity of the grief does not diminish if the mourner experiences multiple bereavements over time. If a woman has already lost one child, the subsequent killings of other children will evoke similar responses, he said. In the majority of cases we studied, it appears as though those who lost multiple kids never actually got used to it. Though Pritzel expects the results of the study may be of some interest to students of Arab psychology, he did concede that the data may not be entirely accurate because it was gathered directly from Iraqis themselves. Almost all the Iraqis we interviewed said the war had ruined their lives because of the incalculable loss of friends and family. Good job, Scott, Pritzel said. But to be totally honest, these types of studies can be skewed rather easily by participant exaggeration. Psychologists and anthropologists have thus far largely discounted the study, claiming it has the same bias as a 1971 Stanford University study that concluded many Vietnamese showed signs of psychological trauma from nearly a quarter of a century of continuous war in Southeast Asia. We are, in truth, still a long way from determining if Iraqis are exhibiting actual U.S.-grade sadness, Mayo Clinic neuropsychologist Norman Blunn said. At present, we see no reason for the popular press to report on Iraqi emotions as if they are real. Pritzel said his research group would next examine whether children in Sudan prefer playing with toys or serving as guerrilla fighters and killing innocent civilians. Ah, the Onion. Thanks, guys. That is a study. Iraqis may experience sadness when friends, relatives die. Via the LouRockwell.com blog, where there are so many great things to read. Yeah, imagine that, Iraqis being human beings. Imagine how you would feel if someone in your family got ripped apart by high explosives. Well, research is beginning to indicate that that's just about how they feel, too, when it happens to them. Amazing, huh? Okay, now actual serious news here. This is from Yahoo.com, reprinting a U.S. News and World Report article here. As President Bush continues to stress al-Qaeda as the chief threat to Iraq's stability, a reprised effort to establish a link between al-Qaeda in Iraq and the 9/11 attackers, U.S. military forces on the ground in Iraq are fighting a complex war in regions with vast networks of overlapping loyalties and few foreign fighters. Most members of al-Qaeda in Iraq, say commanders on the ground, are local Iraqi outcasts. Quote, I can count them, foreign fighters, as a total I have engaged, dead or alive, in the 10 months I've been here on one hand, said Colonel David Sutherland, the U.S. commander of coalition forces in the hotly contested area of Dilaya province, an insurgent stronghold region some 35 miles northeast of Baghdad. There, Sutherland says, those involved in al-Qaeda are largely dispossessed locals, not jihadists who have come from elsewhere. The recruiting program is that al-Qaeda may send 5 or 8 individuals into a village. They recruit from those who have no power base, no place in society. Sutherland has launched roughly 200 operations, both large and small, and says there has been some progress. This, he says, is due in large part to the local reaction to the brutal methods of Al-Qaeda-linked forces. Huh, so there is such a thing as blowback, just not for us. Okay. Sutherland says he has seen growing resentment of Al-Qaeda among Dilaya's residents. People here are so disgusted and disillusioned by Al-Qaeda, no one here wants an Islamic State in Iraq, he said. Well, so there you go. I guess Colonel David Sutherland hates himself and the boys under him, or else he would be parroting whatever talking point the White House wants him to parrot, wouldn't he? Wouldn't he say that our entire crisis here is the massive numbers of foreign fighter religious jihadists known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq since its creation at the end of the year 2004? Obviously, Colonel David Sutherland hates himself, hates the troops, hates his country, hates his wife and children back here in America. Obviously, he is just full of hate, this Lieutenant Colonel. He must hate George Bush, and that's probably his motivation for being critical, right? Is that a credible argument? That's the only argument left in the war party's quill. That's their only arrow. What? You contradict the White House? Well, you hate America, you hate the 4th of July and Thanksgiving and your own family and yourself, obviously, if you're an American soldier in Iraq, contradicting the White House. It's just a shame, you know, see colonels in the United States military hating themselves so much that they are willing to contradict what the government tells them to say. I mean, imagine the self-hatred that this colonel in the United States Army must have for himself and his wife and kids and his family back here in America, for the soldiers under his command, in order for him to say that he can count the number of foreign fighters he's encountered in the 10 months over there on one hand. Golly. You know, that really portends bad for America, that we have soldiers who hate America this much coming back here. You know, armed and trained, experienced. You know, it's really bad for our society. I mean, you know, what other explanation could there possibly be for Colonel David Sutherland saying these things to a reporter from U.S. News and World Report, other than he hates America and wants to destroy it? It's truly sad. All right, here's a clip of Ron Paul, and then coming up right after that, we'll have Joshua Frank from Counterpunch and Dissident Voice on the show. Here's Ron Paul from Joe Scarborough's show yesterday.
Hi, I'm Joe Scarborough. It's Super Tuesday here on MSNBC, where we're breaking down the politics and the people in the presidential race for 2008. We're going to be talking with Republican Congressman Ron Paul, who's hoping to be the next Texan to take the reins at the White House. And he's going to be here answering your questions and your calls. So pick up the phone and call us here at MSNBC. Our number is 888-MSNBC-USA. That's 888-MSNBC-USA. Now, it seems like opposing the war can make very strange bedfellows. Anti-war Democrats are lending their ears and their support to one of the most outspoken voices for bringing the troops home immediately. But it's a voice of a Republican, one who isn't exactly leading the dark horse race, but is a definite contender. And he's my next guest, Congressman Ron Paul, who's proposed a repeal of President Bush's authority to use force in Iraq within the next 6 months. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. Nice to be with you.
Right now you have 19 Democrats who have signed on to your bill, to co-sponsor your bill, including a fellow presidential contender, Dennis Kucinich. Could it be that there's a possible conservative, liberal, presidential teaming up here to help get our troops out of Iraq?
Oh, I think so. And sometimes those labels are misleading. I think if you approach this from a constitutional limit of government viewpoint, that we can join hands with the left as well as the right and come up with a solution and get our troops home, and it makes a lot of sense.
Ron, you've got a lot of excitement, a lot of energy on the internet, and yet if you look at the latest polls, you're still sitting at about 2%. Now, the question is, how's your fundraising gone since word came out that you actually had raised more money or had more cash on hand than Senator John McCain?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers, but I know the daily fundraising over the Internet has remained strong, and we've had some special fundraisers where we've been very happy. You know, for us, if we can go and have a fundraiser and raise $50,000, that's a lot of money. And since we spend it very conservatively, it has been very helpful to us.
Congressman, what right now is the biggest challenge facing the Republican Party? You look at the Democrats. They're raising so much more money than the Republicans. They're ahead in most of the polls. The presidential candidates are winning most of the matchups. Do you think the Republicans are failing right now because they've betrayed their base and they've gone back on the very values that put them in power?
Well, obviously, you know about 1994, and we didn't follow through, and we're a big government party now, a big government conservatives, and this war is a disaster. It's part of the big government. War is the health of the state. We're spending from this, so we're fiscally irresponsible. The Republican Party has lost its way, and if it expects to do any good at all next year, it has to be a party of limited government. But the big problem is, how can you convince the people after the trust that we've lost after all these years? And, of course, that's what I'm offering is a program where the people can trust that I will do what I say.
Is the President of the United States not worthy of conservatives' trust anymore? Has he breached the relationship that the Republican Party once had with conservatives?
Well, it's not so much that that's my opinion, but that's certainly the opinion of the marketplace. I mean, the people out there listening and watching as Republicans, they think it's happening. And you watch how many candidates now are begging and pleading that President Bush comes in and campaigns for him. So the market is speaking that he has lost the support and the confidence of the conservative base of the Republican Party.
Congressman, we have Jonna from Washington, D.C. on, and she wants to ask a question.
Okay.
Hi, Mr. Paul.
Hello.
I'm a student from Wesleyan University, and I was just wondering, how do you plan to appeal to young voters when you're against federal funding of education?
Well, I appeal to them through logic and through the Constitution. Why should it be that people who don't get to college be forced to pay people who get to go to college? That's not fair. And where is it in the Constitution that says that I'm supposed to devise programs like this? There's nothing in the Constitution that says this. And besides, we're broke. I mean, where are you going to get the money? You just have to borrow the money or print the money. And that's what is scaring the young people. If you want to keep the cost of education down, you have to stop the inflation. You have to stop this pretense that you can give education for free. There's nothing free in this world. It's just delay in the payments. And the young people are starting to realize that the payment for education of past generations is falling on the shoulders of this generation, not only for education, for medical care and the military budget and the whole works. So if the young people want education at the right price, they have to look to the program I'm talking about and really seek the answers in the Constitution.
All right. Congressman Ron Paul, thank you so much, and good
thank
luck
you.
On the campaign trail.
Well, the people walk around and say, turn out of very, very popular. They would only need to start to start it. And I'll teach in everything. Aside from all, they would give it to us. And we all appreciate the God. Turns on no and never will. Have a few things we need to start.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 92.7 and 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. It's the 26th of July, and introducing today's guest, Joshua Frank. He's the co-editor of DissidentVoice.com and is the author of Left Out, How Liberals Helped Re-elect George W. Bush. He's got a new book that's coming out next year called Red State Rebels, and you can also find what he writes at counterpunch.org. Welcome back to the show, Joshua.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Scott.
Oh, yeah, it's, well, always good to read your articles and good to talk to you again. And specifically, you have one here on Counterpunch called Hillary's Neocon, The Imperial Vision of Richard Holbrooke. And for those with long-term memory capability, Richard Holbrooke was an aide and a shuttle diplomat type in the Clinton presidency. And you report here that it's very likely that he would be Secretary of State in a Hillary Clinton presidency. Is that right?
Right. I mean, and he was going to be, he was rumored to be tapped for Secretary of State if Kerry had won in 2004 as well. I mean, he's a DLC Democrat with neoconservative ideals, just definitely in line with even, you know, old conservatives like Henry Kissinger. And we've seen his influence in the Democratic Party is pretty strong. He's really helped be an architect for this, what the Democrats are calling this sort of new vision, but really it's just the old vision of the neoconservative agenda. And he has the same sort of game plan for reshaping the Middle East to serve U.S. interests. And we've seen his influence in Hillary's campaign. Her foreign policy is definitely influenced by the Holbrooke philosophy.
Now, what exactly is a DLC Democrat?
Well, he's a member of the, he's not a member of the Democratic Leadership Council, but he's definitely in line with their sort of ideals, the strong sort of military presence, and they're also very pro-corporate wing of the Democratic Party. They're basically the centrist wing of the Democratic Party, except their foreign policy is very right-wing. Definitely in line with the Republican Party, especially under Bush.
Well, it's interesting, you know, so, because the neocons are considered to be centrists as well. You know, they're not very radical in terms of domestic policy and undoing the New Deal and that kind of thing, like some conservatives would want. They're considered more centrist. It makes me think that maybe the centrists aren't the moderates, but they're the extremists, really.
Right. Well, and that's how they play it up, and that's how they've been accepted in mainstream politics today. But if you look at their foreign policy agenda and their overuse of military, and I would say any, you know, use of military forces abroad is overused, but they really want, they think a strong, you know, homeland policy is having a strong military presence overseas. So, of course, they want to expand our military operations in the Middle East. They want to make more bases all over the globe. And, you know, and of course they support Israel's agenda to occupy Palestine and prop up their nuclear arsenal as well. And so we've seen them take a hard line with Iran. We've seen them take a hard line with Iraq before the invasion, the second invasion. And, you know, they want to push this sort of agenda down the road. So if we see a Clinton presidency in 2008, we can definitely expect a continuation of what Bush has done these last 8 years.
Now, in the 1990s, Richard Holbrooke and Clinton and friends, we called them the neoliberals back then, right?
Right. Well, and that was more to do with their foreign policy, or I'm sorry, not their foreign policy, but their economic trade policy. So they pushed through NAFTA, and they were supporting the WTO. And so it was sort of like this agenda to corporatize North America, and they're still pushing for that. There's obviously been a backlash within the Democratic Party for that, and there's been a definite backlash in part of the Republican Party as well. So the neoliberal sort of view is changed somewhat. But, of course, those neoliberals were also in some ways neoconservatives as well. I mean, these are new ideologies, at least new to the American political system that we've seen, and they're pushing these radical agendas. And the military component of both the neoconservatives and the neoliberals is very prominent.
I love this in your article, this high praise for Hillary Clinton from Richard Holbrook. Quote, she is probably more assertive and willing to use force than her husband. She's a classic national security Democrat.
Right, and look how excited he is to boast that Hillary has these credentials, that she's going to be quick to pull the trigger, that she's going to be quick to, and you know, and I think that you could read into that she's going to be taking a hard stance with Iran, and she has said that at APEC conferences, the pro-Israel lobby, and she's also, you know, said that in her foreign policy papers and on the floor of the Senate. So she's definitely prompting to. She's basically letting us know what she's going to do if she is elected, and that is to continue an aggressive foreign policy in the Middle East.
Yeah, well, she's been trying to outflank the Republicans on the right on foreign policy this whole time, and I wonder whether the Democratic voters out there in America are going to be able to catch on to this in time for the primaries, that Hillary Clinton has blood dripping from her fangs. She is an imperialist with the very worst of them.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of Democratic voters, mainstream Democratic voters, vote on social issues, and they may be disgusted with the war, but their litmus test for Democratic candidates is pretty weak, and so they put, you know, Roe v. Wade up there as, like, a number one issue, when it definitely is an important issue. However, I think, you know, imperial policies in the Middle East and our foreign policy platform is much, you know, a much bigger issue that we have to grapple with.
See, you're just like me.
Unfortunately, Hillary isn't going to change those things. She's going to play off of those weaknesses. And we saw that in the last debate on Monday. Here, she's out there saying that she's now a progressive. So she's co-opting almost every kind of ideal that she can in order to sway voters to think that she is an alternative to the Bush doctrine.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're just like me. I think foreign policy comes first no matter what. America's relationship with the world is the number one most important thing, and everything else falls in line after that. And I think, you know, I'd be more than happy, you know, some other time, Joshua, to argue about what the order of the rest of those issues should be on the list. But, you know, you and I are both exactly eye to eye that it's foreign policy that matters most.
And I think that a lot of the Democrats and, you know, people that, and I know libertarians and other people might be on the fence about global warming and those other issues, but to me, even as an environmentalist, I see our military component as driving all of these other catastrophes, whether they be, you know, social, whether they're economic or environmental, and I think our foreign policy and our militarism is at the heart of all of that is really going on, and a lot of the death and destruction, whether it's grizzly bears or, you know, children in Iraq.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you're right, too. Well, just, you know, my kind of thin observations of the Democratic left since, you know, the campaign season began, and I see that not uniformly by any means, but, well, it does seem like to a great degree the people over at Daily Kos, for example, are not just supporting Hillary Clinton, but willing to defend her to the death already. Like, you know, they really don't care.
It's because of this sort of team mentality that you see in American politics, where it's not about ideals, it's not about purpose, it's not about any ethic. It's about winning at all costs. If your team loses, you feel like you lose. And for other people, activists, it's about issues, whatever side they're on, even right-wing activists. They're about issues. So you see these Daily Kos and all those folks. They just want to take back. They don't care about what change comes. In fact, the only change that they're really worried about is the letter next to the president's name, whether it's a D or an R, and that's really what they're concerned with. And, I mean, we can just look back at the last round of congressional elections and the Democrats promising to, you know, take a hard stand on the war, and we've seen nothing but capitulation. And of course, the folks at Daily Kos overwhelmingly aren't going to really question that, those lies and how they were co-opted, because I would say a lot of them probably are anti-war at this point.
Right. Yeah, well, it's a good thing we have Counterpunch around. I pull up Counterpunch this morning, and here's your article detailing how Richard Holbrook, who, as you say, is slated to be a top foreign policy advisor of one kind or another, if not Secretary of State in a Hillary Clinton administration, he was in on one of the left's cause celebres, or however you say that in the plural, the mass murder in East Timor that Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford began. You write in Counterpunch today that Richard Holbrooke helped finish the job.
Sure, and we supposedly had an arms blockade to Indonesia, to Suharto's regime, and, you know, this death and destruction that was going on in East Timor during the Carter administration. But Holbrooke, who was head of the East Asian Division, he authorized illegal shipments of weaponry to his regime to continue these atrocities. And a lot of scholars say at that point in history is actually when it reached genocidal levels. So he, like Hillary Clinton, has blood on his fangs as well. And to not call him out on this, I mean, he really is a Kissinger light. He just hasn't been in as many prominent roles as Kissinger. But we see if Hillary is to win and he is in that prominent role, I think we only have scary things to come.
Well, but Joshua Frank of Dissident Voice, that was way back in the 1970s. Isn't the statute of limitations on mass murder of men, women, and children expired by now?
Yeah, that's what they want us to think. But I'd venture to say that, especially after the quote that you read that I ran in that article, I think it shows that he wants to continue to carry out these atrocities. I mean, these people are essentially, you know, psychopaths. They don't have remorse for their actions. They don't see the connection between their decisions in Washington and the blood on the ground in East Timor or Iraq or wherever it may be. There's this disconnect. There's this lack of any sort of emotion. And it's about power. It's about wealth. It's about capitalizing on the poor, and in this case, capitalizing on you know, military prowess and exploiting whatever we can to dominate. And you know, these guys aren't going to stop unless we stop them. And at this point, unfortunately, Hillary's up in the polls, and looks like it's her election to lose unless some scandal comes out. And unfortunately, it's going to be a ridiculous kind of scandal that will take her down, and not something that is much more obvious, like her complacency in Iraq and her foreign policy agenda in the future.
It's just incredible to me to think that Hillary Clinton, with her record, could be posing as anything like some sort of peace candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I forget the name of the woman who wrote the kind of ghost-written autobiography type thing about Hillary, who talked about her bragging that it was Hillary Clinton who called up Bill on the phone. Apparently, they weren't staying together at the time. But it was Hillary that called up Bill and said, "You better start bombing Serbia. I'm sick and tired of waiting around for you to start bombing Serbia, Bill. Do it now." And he said, "Okay, honey, okay, whatever you say." And that was when the war against Serbia began in 1999.
Right. And I like going back to Holbrooke's quote. He goes on to say something to the effect that, and she actually is going to be more apt to use military force compared to her husband. So, I mean, he thinks she's more of a hawk than Clinton was, or her husband.
God, can you imagine? I mean, Bill Clinton killed a lot of people.
He's proud of this. He's proud of this.
Yeah. I mean, Bill was the mad bomber before Dick Cheney was in power. I mean, Bill Clinton killed, you know, untold thousands of people all across the world.
Right. And not to mention, you know, supporting the U.N. sanctions on Iraq. And, I mean, if you want to even look at the tallies, the pure numbers, he's probably at this point responsible for more deaths in Iraq than Bush is.
Yeah. Well, why don't you explain that?
Of course, he's at the table for the war in Iraq as well.
Wait, hang on a second. Explain that to the listeners. How could it possibly be that Bill Clinton is even in the running for killing more people in Iraq than George W. Bush and Dick Cheney?
Well, during the 90s, there was a blockade UN embargo on Iraq, and there was no allowance of medical supplies to reach people. There was a blockade on all kinds of other goods that researchers in the UN would have said was responsible, if they had had those medications and those food supplies, would have offset the deaths of literally millions of children and elderly people, and all to try to force Saddam Hussein to relinquish his weapons of mass destruction, which at that point is debatable whether they even existed. Most researchers say they didn't even exist then. So, I mean, this was just, you know, in Clinton, of course, the UN was responsible for this, but this was pushed by the Clinton administration. And Clinton propped this up, and he supported this foreign policy and was responsible literally for millions of deaths.
Yeah, no doubt about it. In fact, let's go ahead and play the clip of Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, explaining to Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes how this was all perfectly okay.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
And now that's a clip that most Americans have never heard, but if I remember right from what I've read, this is a clip that every Arab and every Muslim in the entire world has seen probably 500 times. Madeleine Albright saying that the deaths of hundreds of thousands of children was a price that was worth it. And as you said, they were ready, or you didn't say this specifically, but to back up what you said, they were ready to certify Iraq as weapons of mass destruction free in 1997. And the policy was announced at that time that, look, it's no longer about weapons of mass destruction. The sanctions are staying as long as Saddam Hussein is in power, period.
Right.
And they admitted that in the 1990s. They said that outright to the cameras.
Right. And they knew all along that Saddam didn't have weapons-grade uranium, that he did not have weapons of mass destruction, that most of his supplies were destroyed after the initial Bush war in the early 90s in Iraq. I mean, they knew this all along, and the CIA knew it, the Pentagon knew it, the Clinton administration knew it, but they continued to look for an excuse to take out Saddam purely, I think, because... I mean, there's definitely a lot of reasons behind our invasion, and I don't need to go into that or venture to guess what a lot of those motivations were, but we know for a fact that Clinton wanted to take out Saddam, and I think a lot of it had to do with our embarrassing sort of defeat in the early 90s. Saddam wasn't taken out. Bush Sr. had the opportunity, opted not to do it, and Clinton, you know, was going to take back what had happened. And of course, after 9/11, the Bush administration saw it as an opening to go into Iraq, and it saw it as an excuse. So they made up all the ridiculous lies that we all know about now. But they'll continue to do the same lies, and we're seeing the same lies being played out with Iran.
Right.
The New York Times is again complicit in these lies, and we're going to see the same round again. And who's to stop them? They are in power, and it's us that needs to stop them. And whether it's Hillary or Barack Obama or it's Mitt Romney or Giuliani, we're going to continue to see these same policies played out with bloody consequences.
Yeah, there's no question about all of the Republicans except Dr. Ron Paul, of course, who called this the moral crisis of our time. But all the rest of the Republicans were just, you know, piling all over each other, trying to be the first one to say, yeah, I'll nuke them. I'll start a war with Iran and use nuclear weapons in an aggressive war. And as you've reported, among many other people as well, all of the leading contenders on the Democratic side have basically raced to say all options are on the table, including the use of nuclear weapons against Iran that has none.
And how can the American public not see the hypocrisy? Here we are trying to say that they don't have a right to have nuclear weapons, and yet we're saying that we'll use them against them. It's such a ridiculous, shallow, hollow argument that I just can't believe more people don't see it. But again, they do not want to relinquish any sort of power, and they want to dominate the Middle East for their own interests, be they economic or oil or what have you. And that's exactly why we continue to prop up Israel. That's to continue to be a military force in Iraq. And they don't listen to reason. They don't listen to rational arguments. They don't listen to the facts or the truth. We knew long ago what the consequences of invading Iraq would have been. You didn't need to be a Middle East scholar to know that Iraq was a fragmented country and that there was definitely many factors that were going to play into it after the fall of Saddam's regime that the U.S. military or any military could handle. And people knew this. The Pentagon knew it. Everyone knew it. But yet no one stopped it.
Right.
And it's just it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the facts are. It doesn't matter what the truth is. They make up their own rules, and they will do whatever they can to get away with it.
Right. And, you know, I think it's so important that, well, I mean, it just sounds silly, too. You know, it's not like you and I are covering any, groundbreaking truth with this. But, you know, I guess some giant number of the American people out there have no idea. So I figure, you know, it's worth reiterating. Hillary Clinton knew that George Bush and Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld were lying about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. She was the first lady. She, and I don't think anyone will dispute that she was a hands-on policy person. They called Bill Clinton Billary because of their partnership and how closely she worked with Bill Clinton on, especially on foreign policy, as we just talked about. She's the one who really pushed him to start the war against Serbia. How could Hillary Clinton, in 2002, pretend to believe the Republicans who were saying that Iraq went from having nada to all of a sudden having an advanced nuclear weapons program, that they were reconstituting nuclear weapons and could, you know, give a hydrogen bomb to Al-Qaeda and our proof would be a mushroom cloud and the rest of this. She knew that they were lying, and she was lying too.
Absolutely. And if you look back into the latter 90s, all of the leading Democrats were spouting the same round of lies that the neocons and others were after 9/11 about Iraq and about the weapons of mass destruction. You go back to 1997, I believe, when the Iraq Liberation Act was passed during the Clinton administration, and it was basically the preemptive legislation prior to the legislation in 2001 that said we can use military force to oust Saddam. So it's this real... It's the systemic lies. It's systemic in the fact, the real issue here is we don't have any honesty in government, no accountability, and it's a sad state of affairs when we know that they were lying, yet there's nothing that we can do to hold them accountable.
Yeah, yeah, abject liars and bloodthirsty warmongers, all front runners.
Right, and here we are, you know, spinning, trying to figure out why she lied, knew she lied, but the reality is that she's going to continue to lie when she knows that there is going to be horrible consequences, because she is about maintaining power. She really, really wants to be the first woman president, and it's going to take a lot of grassroots efforts on all sides of the political spectrum to stop her or whoever comes out of these nominations. If it isn't like Mike Gravel or Ron Paul, unfortunately, I'd love to see those guys come out. But the reality is, it's about big money, it's about media attention, and it's about celebrityism. And Hillary Clinton is at the top of that pyramid.
Yep, no doubt about it. Hey, let's get back here a little bit to the sickness that is Richard Holbrooke. No offense, Mr. Holbrooke. Sorry. Anyway, so it was, 2002, I think early 2002, not long after the September 11th attacks. I could be wrong about the timing here, but I'm pretty sure it was after September 11th, but before Iraq, and I think it was early 2002. I'm sitting at home, and I'm watching, flipping through the channels, and I find the Charlie Rose interview show on PBS, only Charlie Rose is off. He's at home sick or on vacation or something like that. And so instead of Charlie Rose interviewing anybody, it's Richard Holbrooke, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Richard Haass, and who is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And I'm sorry, I always forget who the fourth one was. And, of course, to my chagrin, I did not record it. But basically, it was the Democratic foreign policy leading lights, or at least the realists. You know, Richard Haass was a PAL guy in the State Department there in the first Bush term. But these are the realist types, you know, and they're sitting around talking about our plans for Africa, and what they were talking about amounted to a full scale invasion of that continent in the name of anything. And it was even funny, like watching. There were a couple of times where, you know, the cameras pick up everything, and you can see these guys giving each other looks like, hey, you know, don't let out too much. You know, remember, we are on camera here as we're having this discussion. But basically what they were saying was, we'll call it AIDS, we'll call it civil war, we'll call it whatever we want in order to justify an American military presence in Africa. There are resources there that we want to steal, and those darkies be damned, was basically the conversation they had. And you mark my words right now, Joshua Frank, Hillary Clinton becomes president of the United States, there will be military forces in Sudan within a year. Probably
absolutely
less.
And these are the Wolfowitz, these are the brains behind the foreign policy of the Democrats, just as influential as Cheney and the rest of the neocons were with the Republicans. These are the core guys behind the Democratic initiative that is now the prominent foreign policy of the party there. And if we are only going to see continuation of this, I mean, these guys are absolutely even friends. As I noted in the Holbrooke piece, he's friends with Paul Wolfowitz. I mean, these guys sit around and talk about this stuff. They agree on more than they disagree on, and that's a very scary precedent, considering that they're supposed to be opposing views.
Yeah. Well, and now, let's see. I saw a poll the other day that said only 57% of people who are still willing to admit that they are Republicans support the war in Iraq. Do you know the numbers on the Democratic side? What percentage of Democrats want out of the Iraq war or want to end to America's imperialist foreign policy in the Middle East? I mean, it's got to be 90%.
I don't know about the imperialist foreign policy, because that would be, they'd have to challenge a little bit more of our doctrines. But I think the Iraq war itself and within the Democratic Party is somewhere hovering. At least I know the 2004 was in the 70s, and I'm sure it's even higher now. So, I mean, this is the majority of Democrats don't approve of the war and didn't before it started.
Yeah, well, it's about 69%.
Yet they're not going to hold the Democrats accountable for it. They still are rather scapegoat and blame Bush and all of the Bush administration instead of saying, well, Bush could not have carried this out had it not been for the continued rubber stamping of funding or legislation to allow Bush to do this, or propping up the same lies as Bush was. Of course, the Democrats were just as complicit, and in fact, maybe even more complicit, because they were supposed to be the opposing party and, in fact, controlled the Senate when this legislation was first introduced.
Absolutely right. Tom Daschle helped shepherd it right through, didn't he?
Right, exactly. And that's something that I think Democrats are quick to forget. It's this short-term memory lapse that we have. I think it's the result of our 24-hour news channel addictions. But we tend to forget just how complicit the Democrats, liberals are in our imperial foreign policy. And there's no, there again, there's no accountability and there's no self-awareness. And it goes back to this the daily cost sort of talk that we were having about how it's more about winning and not about issues, and it doesn't matter what side they're on. It just matters if they win, and it's the horse race that we see every 4 years. We'll see it again in 4 years, and it's again, it's never about issues, real issues. It's always about fluff. It's all about celebrity. It's all about what's going to get you on the Drudge Report. It's about stupid issues and not the real issues. And how do we make those issues real? I mean, and then the people that are out there in those parties making these issues prominent, like Ron Paul, for example, have this outpouring of grassroots support. And of course, that they don't want a guy like Ron Paul in the debates. They don't want a guy like Ralph Nader in the presidential debates. They don't want Pat Buchanan even in these debates, because a lot of Americans will listen and say, man, that guy's right. What are we doing? And they don't want that. They want to consolidate their power. They do not want a democracy. And I think anyone out there that really thinks we live in a democracy has been lied to for far too long. We do not live in a democracy. It's not representative. It's only representative of the people that have access and the corporations that have power and control over the information that we receive and the policies that our elected officials propped up and represent.
Well, I don't think that could be any clearer than it is when you look at the fact that people like Mike Gravel and Dennis Kucinich actually represent the views of the Democratic base, and Ron Paul, not necessarily on foreign policy, because a lot of Republican or a lot of conservatives are are such nationalists that they can't get over the war there, but for, you know, absolutely every bit of the rest of what Ron Paul has to say, you know, that's exactly the point of view of the conservative Republican base, and yet these people are considered the fringe candidates. There's just no question at all. At all. I don't think in the mind of anybody, if you really sat them down and asked them, if there was any question that some powerful billionaire somewhere picked our front runner candidates for us. I mean, if as you say, Ron Paul is the grassroots phenomenon, then how come he's not in first place? Because no one would assert that there's a grassroots phenomenon for Rudy Giuliani or John McCain or Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
They have to pay people to like them, and yet they're all the front runners.
Right. Well, and it goes back to access, and it goes back to we got to understand too that we have almost 50% of our voting age citizens in the United States do not vote, and there's an enormous amount of power if those people were registered and came out to vote. Of course, no one's exciting them to come out to vote, and I think that there's a lot to be said for apathy and laziness when it comes to our electoral system because it's a total fraud. However, there can be some major power in voting, and if someone like Ron Paul or whoever were able to sort of bring those voters out, that's when you would see a real true challenge to the establishment. As it is now, you're just going to have sort of hereditary voters that are Republican or Democrat consistently vote for their party line, rarely cross over, unless, of course, there's just no other option. Like, well, I think right now, I mean, Bush is, who cannot say how horrible this administration has been and the war and all the lies and the corruption and the arrests. And, I mean, and the list goes on. And to think that people still would be voting Republican is outlandish. But a lot of people still are. And I think that's a huge problem. And we don't see any alternatives at this point, or at least the American citizenry do not see alternatives because the media is not going to cover Ron Paul. They don't want him in the debates. They don't want Mike Gravel out there, you know, talking like he is about issues and being straight and frank with people, because that's just not what CNN will like to cover. That's not what Fox News wants to cover. That's not what the New York Times is going to run on their front page. So we have this big lapse between political reality and information that is accessible to people. And that's where I think places like antiwar.com and Counterpunch and these at least for now, free enterprises on the internet that people can access all over the world is an enormous challenge to the corporate established media. And of course, I think that they'll probably want to lock that down eventually and control that as well. But this is, it's free access, free, and this radio show is an example of, I think, the power that can come from the media. And hopefully more people will tune in and get out there and act, because that's what it's going to take before there's any sort of minimal revolution or even any sort of significant reform at the political level.
Well, you know, alternative media like antiwar.com and Counterpunch and Dissident Voice, we are slowly but surely overtaking the mass media in informing the American people. It's still going to be a while before, you know, our voices count more than what they say on TV. But, you know, something you brought up there when you spoke about Bush's abuses of power and the precedents that have been set in not just the violations of American liberty, but just in the form, really, the revolution that has taken place within the form of our government, where in the last 6 years, so much of the powers that were always reserved to the states, to the people, to the Congress, have ended up in the hand of the president. And, you know, an all-powerful Hillary Clinton, you know, a Hillary Clinton with an office twice as powerful as her husband's back in the 1990s scares the hell out of me. You know, she seems like, well, you know the whole thing. It's just like that stupid show with Gina Davis as the woman president of the United States that they had on last year, where she's got to prove that she's got balls, so she sends the army into Virginia to kill people. You know, uses them here domestically, that kind of thing. And that's exactly what I foresee in a Hillary Clinton presidency. You know, you think, you know, they got Almari and Padilla on American soil to be tortured by the military so far, but I think by the time Hillary Clinton's done, you know, we won't be able to count them on all our hands and toes, all our fingers and toes.
Well, and it's a continuation of things that have been going on for quite some time, whether we go back to Waco and Janet Reno and the Clinton administration's murder of people there, the Branch Davidians there, or you talk about Ruby Ridge in northern Idaho. I mean, the crackdown on any sort of anti-government activity, be it even extremist, you know, racist or whatever, has been a part of our history for a very long time, since the birth of this nation. And we're going to continue to see that sort of consolidation of power, use of military force, even on our own civilians, under a Clinton administration. Of course we will. I mean, and this is the kind of thing that the Clintons are popular for. And,
yep.
and definitely with Waco and Clinton and even Wesley Clark, who was in charge of that whole mess. We'll definitely see a continuation of this, whether it's domestically or internationally. And it's all about power. It's about consolidation of power. It's about ripping away civil liberties and the rights of citizens to act and to hold people or government responsible and accountable. And of course, Clinton's going to continue to consolidate that power. And that's exactly what the corporations want, because they continue to profit if that is, it does occur.
Tell me all about dissidentvoice.com.
It's actually dissidentvoice.org, we run, we update the site 6 days a week, and we have a very diverse group of voices. Sometimes we run voices that we don't necessarily agree with all their opinions, but I think it's a good forum for debate, and there's also a section to have comments. And we have some great writers, and I think we're one of the few outlets that is willing to challenge the U.S. foreign policy agenda regarding Israel. We had a lot of good articles on the Finkelstein case at DePaul. We have a lot of really grassroots reporting from Iraq, from Palestine. And it's really just a forum of all voices. We have libertarians that contribute. We have lefties that contribute. We have anarchists that contribute. We have all kinds of voices coming together, because you don't need to be a left-wing person to be a dissident in this country. Plenty of dissidents on all sides of the political sphere.
Absolutely. All right, everybody. Joshua Frank, he's the co-editor of dissidentvoice.org. He's the author of Left Out, How Liberals Helped Reelect George W. Bush. He's got a new one coming out next year called Red State Rebels that he's co-authored with Jeffrey St. Clair from Counterpunch, where he has an article up today, Hillary's Neocon. What's the subheadline? The Imperial Vision of Richard Holbrooke. Thanks very much for your time today, Joshua. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right, everybody, that was Poison Idea. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I want to play for you guys this great speech given by my good friend James Bovard at the recent Restoring the Republic conference that the Future Freedom Foundation held in Reston, Virginia. And this, I'm pretty sure, will run most of the rest of this hour. I got a bunch of things in the news I wanted to get to, but I'm not going to be able to. But I will tell you this, this Saturday, and you'll have to look up all the details on the internet somewhere, but this Saturday there's a big Ron Paul speech fundraiser type thing in San Antonio, some kind of big open public forum in the afternoon, and then a fundraising dinner thing at night. It's taking place within a block from the Alamo somewhere. That's this Saturday afternoon in San Antonio. People want to come out and check out a Ron Paul speech. Here's my good friend Jim Bovard discussing the link between America's imperial foreign policy and the loss of individual liberty here in the United States. So, let's see, there will be a little bit of dead air that I have to fill with a little bit of rambling here before the actual audio kicks in. Here we go.
It's great to talk to an audience as,
James Bovard,
as sophisticated and as well-informed as this, because, you know, that's not normally the situation in Washington. And I want to thank Bumper for his kind words. I've really enjoyed working with FFF over the years, and Bumper has helped protect me against my moderate tendencies, you know, because there have been a number of times where I'm thinking, you know, maybe Bush has got a point. But then I talk to Bumper and I say, yeah, well, maybe he is a rascal. When I was sitting down a couple of days ago preparing this speech, I realized I had a simple choice. The first choice would be to take the high road, and the second choice would be to talk about the TSA. I'm curious, did anybody here have a bad experience flying in? Okay, well, bad news. I mean, the feds have got this under surveillance, and you're going to have a hell of a lot worse time getting home. Now, there was an article by the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, and Heritage was saying that the only change as far as civil liberties since 9/11 is that people have to take off their shoes when they go to the airport. Well, I don't know what kind of shoes that guy wears, but the fact is, thanks to 9/11 and thanks to the federal failure, the failure by the Federal Aviation Administration, the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, thanks to their failure to stop the hijackers, we now have an army of occupation of 45,000 federal agents at these airports. And the feds seem to change the rules each month as far as what you can and cannot do when you're traveling within the U.S. Toothpaste has come in for a lot of grief lately. You know, if it's a large tube, then, you know, you're a suspected terrorist. Rules on shoes, you know, I mean, it's some months you have to take off your shoes, some not. I guess one bright side of that is it's made a lot easier for the TSA to hire new agents, because there are a lot of shoe perverts out there, you know, who really like, here's some nice ones, you know. I mean, you know, you got to check your shoes and make sure they're dry when they come through those things there. So, and TSA is always making up new rules. I mean, TSA is pulling one rabbit out of a hat after another. Back in August, September of 2003, there was a bombing some Chechen terrorists apparently blew up a Russian airplane, and there wasn't really good evidence as far as how the terrorists, blew it up. But the TSA assumed that the terrorists were female and that they had hidden a bomb in their brassiere. So TSA proceeds to treat every, ample female in the country traveling as if she was carrying breast bombs. And, you know, there was just a huge scandal. You know, it was something which just kind of started overnight. There was no warning. There was no public discussion. There was, there was no one to tell the TSA, hey, you boneheads are out of your minds. It didn't matter because the TSA had the authority. The TSA makes the TSA makes the rules. It enforces them and it judges all the violators. And this is exactly the type of paradigm that James Madison warned against as the epitome of tyranny. Something that the TSA has started to do a couple years ago is impose attitude fines of up to $1,500. I mean, TSA did not announce this either. But if someone is going through the TSA line, it doesn't matter if they've been delayed for half an hour and missed their flight, or if some TSA person has given them grief and the person talks back to them, the TSA can fine you up to $1,500. And often a person has no notice of this until they get a letter in the mail, a few weeks or a month or two later. I assume this is a program to make the government safe from sarcasm. But this is the type of thing that has multiplied since 9/11. You have people making up rules, not telling Americans about them, and simply, trying to make Americans grovel at the feet of federal agents. And there has been a consistent message from parts of Washington and parts of Congress and the Bush administration that groveling will make us safe. But it hasn't worked for people in the past in other countries, and it won't work for Americans now. Something which is really striking to me about how the war on terror has changed America, it has brought out the latent authoritarianism in this country, more so than even I expected. I mean, if you think back a few years ago to how the Dixie Chicks were vilified for just a casual comment that their lead singer made in a concert in England, if you look at how many conservatives have been calling for the New York Times to be prosecuted for treason, simply because the New York Times has had some stories about federal law breaking. If you look at some of the prominent conservative columnists who are calling for the creation of concentration camps in this country for Muslims or Arabs, and, you know, these are best, the one person that did this is a best-selling author. These are things that would have been very difficult to imagine even a few years ago. And to see where the trend lines are going in this country, it's very, very concerning. But a lot of the news media tells us that the war on terror is not a threat to you unless you're a terrorist, or unless you're a terrorist suspect. And that second category, it kind of, blossoms. Looking back to what the feds did after 9/11, the feds rounded up more than 1,200 people and locked them up, and in many cases violated their rights, held them in violation of court orders. And the only thing a person needed to do to be considered a suspected terrorist was to be a Muslim or an Arab who was an illegal immigrant who was encountered by FBI agents in New York or New Jersey. That was what it meant to be a suspected terrorist. Arab students were locked up as suspected terrorists for working at a pizza parlor in violation of their student visa. A Pakistani immigrant was jailed as a suspected terrorist because his neighbors called him in because he failed to cut the grass and he hung his underwear out on the fence. That was pretty suspicious. There were some FBI agents, the FBI was under a lot of pressure to bring in people for questioning. Some FBI agents were told to look in phone books to find the names of Arabs and Muslims who could be interrogated. These are the standards the government was using after 9/11. Now, and it's gotten worse since then in some ways. The Homeland Security Department in May 2003 urged local police departments to view critics of the war on terror as potential terrorists. The feds told local lawmen to be on alert for potential suicide bombers. And the feds said that the suicide bombers could be recognized by things such as having a pale face from a recent shaving of a beard. Or for instance, a person might appear to be in a trance, or their eyes might appear to be vigilant and focused. And the feds warned that suicide bombers might be someone whose clothing is out of sync with the weather. I've heard that from quite a few people who flew in here and didn't realize that, it's summer here in D.C. The feds also warned that if someone's clothing is loose, that could be a sign of a suicide bomber. I don't know how many college campuses these folks have visited recently, but, and perhaps to ensure that there will never be a shortage of terrorists, the feds warned that another telltale warning sign is that someone for whom waiting in a grocery store line becomes intolerable. You know, and these are the experts at Homeland Security. This is what they're telling 18,000 federal, local, and state law enforcement agencies around the country. And this is some of the stuff that's leaked out. You know, it's possible there's much more comical stuff we haven't heard about yet. But this is, you know, this is what these folks are getting away with. It's interesting to see some of the other definitions that federal agencies have used here. The Pentagon is doing a lot of surveillance inside the U.S. now. This is in violation of federal law. They've been caught breaking the law a number of times, and each time they've explained, well, it wasn't intentional.
Oh, sorry for the dead air. Here it comes. Listen, James Bovard at the FFF conference.
And that satisfies Congress. And, you know, they, you know, it wasn't a concern for the Bush administration because they haven't been impeded by the law for a long time. But, for instance, the Pentagon has got a counterintelligence field activity program that's out there covertly gathering information on Americans who protest against the Iraq war or who are involved with websites that are critical of U.S. military policy. I was talking to Don Rumsfeld about this last week, and he said that FFF is not on the list. So, you know, people don't need to worry about that. But the Pentagon has carried out scores of surveillance of a lot of anti-war protests and gatherings, including one at a Quaker meeting house in Florida. Names of people who go to these kind of things are added to a Pentagon database base which involves terrorism threat warnings. And this is something which would be on your permanent federal record. And folks might have this notion, well, you know, but there's due process, you know, this information would not be used against me. You know, it's fine to have a healthy fantasy life, but, you know, these are not the rules that the government plays by. And the federal law is less and less of an impediment to the Bush administration every year. Something we learned in late 2005 was that the National Security Agency had conducted thousands of warrantless wiretaps on Americans. This is something that the New York Times was told about a month or two before the 2004 election, but they chose not to publish it, and therefore the New York Times may have gotten Bush a second term because they were basically cowardly on this. During the 1970s, there were horrendous abuses of the federal government doing wiretaps on Americans for supposedly national security reasons. There were White House aides. I think Bill Safire was wiretapped. Henry Kissinger had him tapped. There were no limits on this. It was simply up to the president to decide who would be tapped. Congress recognized that there were horrendous abuses there. There was a law passed in 1978 called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which makes it a crime to do a wiretap without a warrant. It could be a warrant from the secret court, this FISA court, which is pretty much of a joke because it simply rubber stamps almost everything the government asks for. But there is at least some record there. But the Bush administration decided that even seeking a warrant was a violation of his dignity, and that the president had his own inherent authority to order wiretaps of Americans' phone calls. This is the very clear doctrine that Bush lawyers have established. It's something that Alberto Gonzalez referred to as the commander-in-chief override. And so basically you have the entire U.S. Constitution. You know, well, that's a technicality because George Bush has to protect America. And that has been their attitude on almost, you know, on many areas. And the type of wiretaps that they're doing, feds have wired, we don't know who they're wiretapping. And Congress has not shown a lot of, you know, curiosity. But these are the type of scandals which tend to snowball. I mean, things are probably a hell of a lot worse than what they seem, because that has been the pattern for every type of Bush violation of law so far. Something which came out last May was that the feds have been doing call tracking for millions of Americans. The feds have been tracking every number which a person would call or be called by, and creating these massive data warehouses. This is completely illegal under a 1986 federal law. But the feds have just kind of shrugged that off, and you know, they haven't worried about that. Now, it's interesting what the rule of law has become, because there were a lot of concerns in the Justice Department about whether these secret wiretaps were illegal. But during the time Ashcroft was Attorney General, it basically got rubber-stamped every time, and the Bush administration's attitude was that if the Justice Department said it was legal, there was no need to go to a court. I mean, it was self-evident that it was legal. There was a glitch one time because the program was expiring, and Ashcroft was in the hospital after having some kind of, was it gallbladder or something like that, and he wasn't really that conscious. But it was necessary for him to certify that the program was in compliance with the law, or else it would look like Bush and his team were breaking the law. So you had Andrew Card, the White House Chief of Staff, and Gonzalez raced over to Ashcroft's hospital room to pressure him to sign this waiver of federal law to let them keep on wiretapping. Well, as a former Deputy Attorney General Comey testified a few weeks ago, he heard that they were on the way, and he raced there to Ashcroft's hospital bed. You know, it had to be a hell of a scene, you know, because, you know, John Ashcroft didn't make much sense when he was sober, you know. And to think of John Ashcroft, you know, kind of zoned out on painkillers, and then, you know, I mean, to have the White House Chief of Staff and the, you know, and Gonzalez, who's, I've always had a lot of respect for his scholarship on the law, you know, to have those guys by Ashcroft's hospital bed, and Comey there is arguing, and Bob Mueller apparently came and supported Comey, and, you know, and so they were not able to get this certified as being legal, but Bush said, well, on a temporary basis, just keep doing it on my authority. You know, there was people were concerned about this in the Justice Department, and a investigation was launched early last year on this. But George Bush scuttled the investigation. It was looking at whether Gonzalez, as a White House counsel, and Bush, primarily Gonzalez, but with Bush's approval, whether they had violated federal law with this warrantless wiretapping. But George Bush effectively scuttled that investigation. Now, this was in the papers briefly. If you think back to the early 1970s, Nixon did some similar things, and people got really upset. But for some reason, this has rolled off people's back like water off a duck's back. The news media has chosen to make very little hubbub over this. But it looks like a very clear case of a president, you know, basically sculling an investigation into his own criminality. At some point, you know, there's got to be a conflict of interest there. Now, thing with the wiretaps, this is something which plays into a lot of the other stuff the Bush administration is doing. There was a provision in the Patriot Act which greatly expanded the FBI's authority to use national security letters. And a national security letter is simply an FBI subpoena, but it has the force of law. I mean, it's something which, and not only that, but it's the legal equivalent of an FBI going in there and holding holding a sword over somebody's head, because someone who receives one of these national security letters is prohibited from telling anybody. They were even prohibited from telling their lawyer up until very recently. And the Bush team said, well, this is not really a problem because these are things which were being used very rarely. Well, they lied. It turns out the FBI was issuing at least 30,000 national security letters a year. And these are 30,000 warrantless searches. These are under supervision of no judge. I mean, it's simply some FBI office, you know, asking, say, well, you know, shall we search this guy's records? And they say, yeah, okay, fine. That's due process with these national security letters. And as the Washington Post noted, these letters empower the FBI to seize records that show where a person makes and spends money, with whom he lives and lived before, how much he gambles, what he buys online, where he travels, how he invests, what he searches for and reads on the web, and who telephones or emails him at home or work. And there is no need for a warrant for this because it's on the FBI's own authority. And each national security letter can lasso the personal records of thousands of people. So the 30,000 is a very low number. For instance, in late 2003 and early 2004, the FBI used national security letters to seize personal data on almost a million people who visited Las Vegas around New Year's. And once again, there was no need to even talk to a judge. It was the FBI going to these hotels and casinos and other entities out there and just kind of saying, you know, give us the information or, you know, very bad things will happen.
Anti-War Radio, Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Listening to James Bovard's speech at the Restore the Republic conference.
Something which the FBI did, it threatened to get the gambling profiles of casino guests if the casinos did not surrender more information. So that's something else that could be added to your federal record. And the standard, for a search warrant, there's a clear standard in the Fourth Amendment. There has to be probable cause. It has to specify what is being looked for and where it is. And, you know, there has to be, in theory, a clear link to a suspected crime. But for these national security letters, the only thing necessary is that for the FBI agents to certify that the records which they compel people to give are sought for or relevant to investigation to protect against international terrorism or clandestine intelligence agent activities. We saw earlier how broad the definition of terrorist was. There's no reason to think that it's any narrower here. And there's evidence that the feds could use these to go after online blogs which are criticizing Bush, for instance. Because the FBI's concept of First Amendment protection at this point is very thin. And yet, these are things Americans have heard very little about, but they are fundamentally changing how people interact with the federal government. The government is becoming a much bigger peril to people's freedom. Now, I've never understood the basic idea that killing people abroad would not encourage government to respect people at home. But there are a lot of people who seem to think that if America is tough enough in foreign countries, that we will somehow be safe here at home. But it's the same government and the same bad habits tend to spread and come back this way. It's interesting to think back 6 years ago, early summer 2001, who would have thought at that point that the U.S., that the law of the land in this country would be that the government has a de facto right to torture. 6 years ago, who would have expected that? And not only that, we have an attorney general who was a primary advocate of using torture and making the federal government exempt from the law. And this is our chief law enforcement officer, at least for this week. But it's interesting going back and seeing some of the things which have leaked out of the Bush administration, and I think we haven't even seen the tip of the iceberg in this torture scandal. I think that there's far worse things that have gone on that we don't know about. I'll allude to them a little bit here, but there was a memo which the Justice Department did in 2002 which laid out their strategy on torture. Now, it started out by basically changing the definition of torture to say if someone was not killed or maimed, he wasn't tortured. I mean, this is a pretty low standard for torture. And this Justice Department memo then explained that even if someone did die during torture, the torturer might not be guilty if he felt that the torture was necessary to prevent some greater evil, if that was how he felt. And this Justice Department memo concluded by declaring the president has a right to order torture because he is above the law, at least during wartime, if the president says it's wartime, no matter what Congress says. The Justice Department said the president can exempt government officials from federal criminal law saying that Congress cannot compel the president to prosecute outcomes taken pursuant to the president's own constitutional authority. In other words, a federal agent can do whatever the president orders him to, and the president has no obligation to prosecute this person. The president can block prosecution simply because the president's authority is superior to the law and the Constitution. This is a memo that leaked out in either late May or June 2004. There was a brief hubbub about kind of, some people said, you know, that's kind of going too far, you know. But this was the Bush administration's version of the law of the land, and it still rules. Because when it has come to this with the wiretapping scandal and other scandals, the administration's fallback position is, well, George Bush has inherent authority. If the president says it's legal, it's legal. The rule of the law at this point means nothing except presidential supremacy, because the president is the law. And it's amazing that there's been so little controversy on these things. Now, Congress, there was some Supreme Court decisions in June of last year that overturned some of these policies and made it clear that the court felt that the Bush administration was violating the law and probably the Constitution. Bumper Hornberger did a lot of fine articles on that back at that point, and Future Freedom Foundation has been the front line on these issues. But the Bush administration responded not by trying to change the policies, but by browbeating Congress to rubber stamp torture, which Congress did with the Military Commissions Act last September. And this is, you know, this is an absolutely fascinating act. I was reading the history of, it's fascinating to see some of the parallels with other history. And there were a turning point in the history of the Nazi regime was the Night of the Long Knives. That was when Hitler ordered the execution of a lot of the top people in the SA, the counterpart to the SS. A lot of them were just rounded up and executed point-blank range. After that happened, the Nazi Reichstag passed a law a day or two later which retroactively legalized all the executions and said they were necessary for the protection of the state. Well, Congress, with this Military Commissions Act, effectively retroactively legalized torture. And according to the Pentagon, there have been like at least 30, 34 or more people who have died either during or as a result of these interrogations. And that's only for the Pentagon. For the CIA, we have no idea what their body count is from torture, because the CIA is simply, you know, chosen not to reveal what it's doing. But the parallels, and it's fascinating to see the standards that Congress approved. For instance, there was a, you know, something which I found most chilling in this law was that Congress has approved the use in judicial proceedings of tortured confessions. I mean, this is an idea that one would have thought would have been limited to Monty Python movies.
Yeah, it's not on yet.
But one of the top Justice Department officials said in federal court in late 2004 that the Bush administration could use tortured confessions in some of his court proceedings, and Congress last September basically rubber-stamped that. Now, it's important that it not be labeled a tortured confession. Instead, it can simply be a confession that occurred under vigorous interrogation, or maybe extreme interrogation, or maybe rough interrogation. But what the Military Commissions Act does, it leaves it up to the president to say what torture is. And now, y'all might recall after 9/11, George Bush spent. The Abu Ghraib pictures came out in May of 2004, George Bush spent a lot of time assuring Americans, "We don't torture." Well, you know, some of those photos would have been problematic because, I mean, you had people, you know, bleeding. You had people beaten. There was one guy who had been tortured to death. and he was being carried out of Abu Ghraib and, you know, covered in a on a stretcher, and they had an IV hooked up to him to make it look like he wasn't dead. And there have been a lot of other people who have been killed during interrogation in Iraq by American, the American military, the CIA, or some of our contractors. But George Bush says, don't worry, that's not torture. Now, and it's up to Bush to define what torture is now. This is problematic because Bush is, you know, pressing George Bush for an honest definition, I mean, it's just not prudent at this point. Bush appears to be using a John Yoo definition of what torture is. John Yoo was asked, he was the former Justice Department official who wrote that 2002 memo. John Yoo was, and he's been out front in favor of torture in the last couple of years since he left the government.
Listening to James Bovard's speech at the FFF Restoring the Republic conference earlier this month. Here goes part four, Radio Chaos.
He was asked in a law school debate about a year ago whether it would be okay to, you know, crush the testicles of a young boy if the president thought that the boy's father would have a might have information where a bomb was. John Yoo really struggled with that question. He said, you know, I don't know, you know, that's a rough one, you know. And this is the person who the media is treating as an authority on interrogation policy. I mean, it's fat, and he's appeared at many Washington think tanks. He's been treated as a visionary thinker. I assume that the, I will not draw any historical parallels with last century, but it's amazing to see where the standards have fallen. Habeas corpus is another thing which has fallen by the wayside. A major problem with this Military Commissions Act is that the president can accuse anybody in the world of being an enemy combatant and have that person detained indefinitely. And a person does not have the right to have access to federal courts to challenge once they've been labeled an enemy combatant. This is a revolutionary change. This is the president's right to nullify all rights. And this is something, again, which generated very little controversy at the time that Congress was considering this act. But the and folks think, well, this is only for foreign bad guys, but there is no reason to assume that these powers would be so limited because Bush has not respected any limits on his power so far. I mean, everything is a stepping stone. Where are they going next? And we don't know. And there's no reason to trust these people. It's and, you know, Bush has tried to portray the torture scandal as something which happened by a handful of people at Abu Ghraib and some of his apologists and some of his people perhaps off the record have said, well, it was just a bunch of hillbillies from West Virginia. You know, these hillbillies were following orders. And there was there was a trial for the corporal who was actually from Pennsylvania on this. And my impression was that the corporal was guilty of a lot of stuff, but he was prohibited from introducing into the military court-martial record. He was prohibited from entering into evidence that he was following higher orders from higher up. And this is how they've handled the torture scandal throughout. They have thrown a handful of enlisted men to the legal wolves. They have had a few officers who were, you know, got a sanction on their career. We don't know how high up this goes. However, there was a CIA letter that came out late last year, which confirmed that George Bush granted the CIA the authority to use extreme interrogation methods. And it spelled out what these methods were.
I've lost my way.
This is from George Bush himself. And
two?
The actual letter itself has not come out yet. I think it will come out. And it's possible that when that does come out, that might have the same effect as the Watergate tapes had on Richard Nixon.
Thanks a lot.
On the other hand, maybe I'm overestimating the American people on that. Maybe people will simply shrug and say, well, you know, the Fox 24 program at work there, so, you know, we'll just give them the benefit of the doubt on this. But it is just, it's fascinating to see how deferential Americans have been to the government seizing nearly absolute power in area after area. I mean, something that was great about this country was Americans had a natural skepticism of politicians and of government authority, or even healthier people distrusted government per se. And but that's something which has been lost. I was fascinated by the opinion polls, the opinion numbers in the weeks after the 9/11 attacks. Trust in government doubled overnight. The percentage of Americans that trusted the government to do the right thing was up in the 60 or 70%. And this is after the biggest federal screw-up since Pearl Harbor. But it was this surge in trust in government that was the reason that Bush could con the American people into war with Iraq. And that's why Bush has gotten away with so much other law-breaking, because people trusted the government. And if there's any lesson from the post-9/11 world, is that the more esteem the government gets, the more dangerous it becomes. And yet, people are not drawing that lesson, and I'm concerned with the presidential race heating up for 2008. I mean, it seems as if people are only looking for a better master, someone with good intentions, someone who's trustworthy. But it doesn't matter who's president. There's way too much power, and that power is going to be abused. And the only answer is to put these rascals on a leash. But I don't know how much of the old American values are still out there that this is going to resonate with. And I also don't know how many Americans still give a damn about individual freedom. Because to see how far the government has gone, and to see how little controversy there has been about these illegal wiretappings, and about the torture, and about the TSA abuses, people have rolled over again and again. Where will it stop? I don't know. So many of these policies have been justified in the name of anti-terrorism. But the single most effective anti-terrorism step the U.S. government can take is to stop killing innocent foreigners around the world. It's time to have a supply-side anti-terror policy. Because so much of what the U.S. government has done has simply spawned far more terrorists than what the U.S. has vanquished. And there's no evidence that Washington has chosen to recognize that or learn that lesson. Because of that, government has become far more dangerous. It has created far more enemies for the American people at the same time as promising to save us. One more good reason to be cynical about government. So on that note, happy to take some questions. Yeah.
Why has American people in general dropped their guard?
All right, everybody. Here's the question and answer session. I don't know if we'll be able to hear all the questions.
Well, people have been.
Jim, I want to hear Bovard's answers, so listen up.
Yeah, the excellent question. Why have the American people dropped their guard against government? Why are people trusting the government so much? Excellent question. People have been taught from the time that they're knee high to bow down to the flag, to say the Pledge of Allegiance, to put the government on a pedestal. And this has blunted a lot of people's natural reactions. It's something that the news media, I mean, a major reason that the Bush administration could con America into war was because the news media, for the most part, was a lapdog, if not a bootlicker. And this is certainly true of a lot of the right-wing media. It was also true of the Washington Post and of the New York Times and the three major networks. These folks were a complete disgrace. They were cowardly. They were knowingly putting out dubious administration statements as if they were true. And it's unfortunate there's been so little backlash against the media, because these folks enabled George Bush to violate the law, to violate the Constitution, and to trample our rights. And most of these, I mean, you know, for the Washington media, all that matters is that high-ranking presidents, high-ranking administration officials still come to their table and be their guests at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That's their standard. That's what they're concerned about. That's where their bragging rights come from. These folks are afraid to offend the federal government. And that's probably the reason why we should have no trust in the media. No trust in the media except for Freedom Daily.
This is Jim Bovard at the FFF conference in Reston, Virginia.
Yeah, I'm Bill Anderson from Cumberland, Maryland. Are we seeing much more of a growth of what I would call military culture in this country, in which, because I'm thinking it's not simply just these U.S. adventures, economic adventures abroad, but also when they come home, that we're seeing more and more military retirees or people with military backgrounds in all the bureaucracies. And this is not a slam on people in the, you know, who've been in the armed services, but rather I'm wondering if there's, you know, you get this culture, isn't it, like of obedience? You know, you simply obey orders because that's what you do in the armed forces. You obey orders, and I'm wondering how far is this, you know, seeping into these other agencies that seem to be demanding just absolute obedience.
I think that might be part of it. I mean, it's amazing how many Americans have been happy to take orders from the federal government. This is something which I see when I'm traveling and I'm stuck in a TSA line, and, you know, naturally I'm always trying to chat people up, kind of like, you know, so what do you think of this, you know? And there's always a fair percentage of people like, I'm really glad they're there that they're protecting me. And, you know, I'm just sorry I don't have a title for the Brooklyn Bridge to sell these people there in line. I mean, it's amazing how much BS smart people have swallowed. And okay, there's a certain percentage of people that when it comes to politics, they will never know their nose from a hole in the ground. But there are the thing that struck me, and I see this a lot with the Washington media, is that these folks should know better. After the history of COINTELPRO, the FBI spying and abuse of the 1960s and 70s, there was no reason to assume that the surveillance that the Justice Department was openly conducting after 2002 would not be a peril to our liberties, would not be used to suppress dissent, and would not trample the rights and liberties of the American people. But the news media, it just lost its nerve. It just lost its nerve. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. The news media has not lost its nerve. I'm a local journalist, but I've been in direct...
For who?
What?
For who?
Well, for the Gazette newspapers in Gaithersburg in Maryland.
Montgomery County. That's a real
hotbed
of liberty.
Yes.
A hotbed of liberty.
Well, you've got to start...
Folks here know Montgomery County, right? I don't need to say anything else. I'm sorry.
Should I move? Why not stay and fight at home? I've tried, and I've become a community activist. I've talked to Jacob about this. I have spoken at microphones. This involves a usurpation or a taking of private land. The basis of freedom is ownership of private land, and our land is threatened.
Okay.
It's the collusion between developers and government. And it starts right with the local level. I can see it. I've been speaking before a microphone since last November. I know I've been effective because one of the councilwomen has cut me off. She refuses to accept my emails anymore.
Okay.
But
is there a
here's
question?
The thing. Yes. The question is how do you handle it when you are indirectly, a journalist is indirectly threatened with a lawsuit?
Hmm.
These little, you talk about torture.
Okay, okay.
Ways of torturing journalists.
Okay, well, you know, the first rule is never take legal advice from a freelance writer.
I'm a freelance writer.
Well, so am I. It's something which varies from circumstance to circumstance. I think that there's some lawyers here who might be able to give you a lot better advice than I could on that.
Okay,
so.
I'm taking paralegal courses this summer.
Okay,
I'm working with lawyers. I'm not going to stop speaking.
Okay, good. Keep
I'm
speaking.
I'm not going to stop writing.
Good. Keep speaking. Okay. Next question.
I was shocked to hear about the national security letters that you spoke about. They seem to be such an obvious violation of individual rights. Can they be used as a basis for a civil rights suit against the government?
The ACLU, I think the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, I believe, and some other groups are suing the feds on these at this time, and they've gotten some discovery in the courts. They have found some stuff. You know, it's interesting. There's sort of a stereotype about the ACLU. A lot of people have a visceral, hostile reaction to them. But the ACLU has done some of the best work in the last 5 years in this country. There are a number of issues I strongly disagree with the ACLU on, but they have been very courageous on a lot of the worst Bush abuses. And it's interesting on something like torture. The folks in New York, ACLU, Center for Constitutional Rights, Amnesty, those folks have been in the forefront of torture, and all of the think tanks in D.C. have done almost nothing on this, or else they've been in favor of that. And that includes think tanks that you would have expected to be concerned about these kind of abuses. But it's been the organizations in New York, not D.C., that have been in the forefront on that.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, everybody, you listen to James Bovard at the Restoring the Republic Conference in Western Virginia, the FFF.org. He's the author of Attention Deficit
Gene Carlin, Portland, Maine.
Yeah.
My question is, how has the war on terror impacted the Freedom of Information Act requests?
Well, you know, I hate to sound cynical.
Oh, please do.
You know, because I was trying so hard to kind of, you know, change my image and come across as cheerful. No, the Freedom of Information Act, the federal act, it was bad before Bush got in. It's a lot worse now. And there's, I think, a lot more open contempt. And it's frustrating that a lot of people think, well, Freedom of Information Act, that's simply like a special interest for journalists. I mean, so many people don't give a darn that they have no idea how the government's using the power over them. And it's been a number of the Freedom of Information Act requests which were answered in part, which have alerted people to there are far greater abuses going on now. But I've written a little bit about that. It didn't do any good. And Congress has a... Congress has passed a law to improve how that would be handled, but there's one senator who's put a secret block on the law going on the bill becoming law. And with the way the Senate works, it's possible for that one senator to do that secretly, and we have no idea which U.S. senator has sabotaged making the Freedom of Information Act work a little bit better. I mean, this is the kind of thing that could make people lose faith in Congress.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah.
I'm John Walsh. I'm from Cambridge, Mass. And since it did come up, I'm a member of the ACLU. But I'd like to ask you why you think the libertarian outlook hasn't been more at the forefront of the anti-war movement. I think that the libertarian point of view has a great hold and a great credibility on the American populace, but many people who don't regard themselves as liberals don't know and don't know about this and don't have anyone to follow in opposing the war.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I've been surprised that the libertarian message and movement has not resonated far more broadly with the anti-war efforts. There's a wonderful website, antiwar.com. Their chief columnist is speaking here tomorrow, I think, and those folks do great work. But the anti-war message has been almost entirely from the liberal left, and I don't have a good answer for that. I mean, there are editors which I've worked with that seem almost not that comfortable with the fact that I would be very critical of Bush, but yet I would not be in favor of the Democrats. They seem really perplexed by that. And I think part of the trouble is that the editors. What do I say in public? I mean, there are. I think the older generation of editors had a better understanding of how the libertarian message fit in. I mean, it was partly Ronald Reagan at least before he became president, sounded fairly libertarian at times. And I think that that word may have had more resonance with people, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But I think part of the reason is that parts of the libertarian movement were in favor of the war. There were folks at Cato that were very, very openly in favor of the war. Some of the people at Reason Magazine were openly in favor of the war. People like at the Independent Institute, Bumper, Mises Institute, those folks were all staunchly against the war and never wavered or flinched. But, you know, Cato and Reason probably have a little more visibility than some of the vehemently anti-war folks. But, you know, I've asked myself that question, and I don't have a good answer. So, yeah.
Sam Bostack, University of Dallas. I'm a libertarian who has cooperated with the anti-war movement, and I can speak to that point.
Okay.
And I would say one of the things that one has to do is bite one's tongue when you're around progressive Democrats and the other liberals in the anti-war movement, because so many of their other positions are so repugnant to libertarian views, and it's difficult to fit in. So you have to focus on that one issue, anti-war or pro-peace, and write and speak to that issue along with them as comrades for that one issue. So it's an ad hoc alliance.
Good
and
advice.
I think a lot of libertarians are unwilling to do that because you do have to mingle. And you have to listen to things you don't want to hear.
It drives me to drink. Yeah.
I was wondering about the American public being all that. I thought I was. Okay. With regard to a choice between civil liberties and continued existence, which a lot of people perceive, whether it's correct or not, is immaterial, choosing continued existence is not a stupid choice.
If you trust the government to give you honest
information. I understand.
Yeah.
I understand.
That's hell of a caveat.
Yeah, that's a big problem. I'll grant that.
Where was I going with this?
I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. With regard to committing torture, I can envision hypotheticals under which I would do it. Were I structuring a society and writing laws, I would certainly outlaw it. Would I always abide by those laws? I don't think so. With regard to hypotheticals, I'm interested, have you ever thought of a circumstance under which you would commit torture?
Well, I have worked with some editors that were late in paying.
Well, there's a good example, I suppose. All right. Well,
I
think one can be reasonable, and I think one can envision circumstances where one would do that.
Okay. I mean, this is, you know, it's interesting how there's that faith in the hypothetical, because the first, you know, way back in my youth, I used to write about agriculture policy, and it was funny. It was fun to see how congressmen and agriculture economists would have these very complex models. And they would prove that if these 27 things all happened this way, that government intervention would be a net benefit to society. Mm-hmm. As long as all these 27 things happened the same way. You know, and even if someone did write a proposal like that, it would go before the House Agriculture Committee, and some congressman would say, yeah, well, you know, it's important to double the money for my farmers. And boom, it's all out the window. With torture policy, you have people talking about, you know, the ticking time bomb scenario, but who is tortured and why? If you look at the history of recent U.S. policy, you have people, there was a taxi cab driver who was nabbed in Afghanistan. There's now an award-winning movie about his case. He was nabbed out there. He was wrongly suspected of being a terrorist, and what the U.S. agents did was hang him up and beat him to death. And I don't know what information that they were thinking of, but there was never any reason to first even arrest the guy, much less interrogate him, much less beat him to death. This is at Bagram Air Force Base. This is the same place that Cheney visited last year, and you know, there was a bomb that went off a mile away from him, so he was treated like a combat veteran when he got back.
I know it's hard to believe that government would wish you
power. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
What can you tell us about the executive orders that Bush has signed recently, particularly regarding the National Guard and his being able to take that over?
Well, thanks for asking. I did an article for American Conservative Magazine last month on that. I've got a link to that on my website, jimbovard.com. Congress passed a law, a provision in a Defense Authorization Act last September, which basically made it far easier for the president to declare martial law. As I asked in the article, how many pipe bombs does it take to end American democracy? A lot fewer than it did a year ago.
All right, everybody, last segment here of James Bovard's speech at the Restoring the Republic conference in Reston, Virginia, put on by the Future of Freedom Foundation. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin.
This law is very vague and expansive, and it basically says that the president can seize power and send in the National Guard if there is a terrorist incident or some other incident. And other incident is not defined. So, you know, and Bush has a history of kind of squeezing a lot out of these kind of vague phrases. But Congress basically gave no oversight to this. Senator Leahy of Vermont did great work. He said this is a law. If we pass this, we could have martial law. It makes no sense to give the president this power. But for instance, with this new law, say for instance, it'd be possible for the president to use the National Guard to suppress it'd be possible for the president to use the Mississippi National Guard to suppress an anti-war demonstration in Boston. Or it'd be possible for him to send the New York National Guard to go down and disarm people in Mississippi if they didn't give up their personal weapons in response to the next Federal Gun Control Act. I mean, this is a huge seismic change. It makes the president more dangerous, and almost nobody in Washington paid attention or gave a damn.
I'm John Matfis from Boston. It's always frustrating being a libertarian, as we probably all know. We are all viewed as wackos and crazy and radical and all those kind of things. And then you can come to a group like this, and there are other people who believe
lots
in freedom.
Lots of wackos.
Lots of wackos. So it's kind of nice to be in that kind of group. But what can we as individuals, would you suggest we do? I mean, we obviously have a lot of people here, and as single people, we don't really have that much power, but as a united group, do you have any suggestions of what we can do to fight against this ever-encroaching federal government? And what can we as individuals, how can we make changes to this government policy?
You know, there isn't a silver bullet, but it's really great if people get more informed. Because I've known a lot of people that were whose heart was in the right place, but they didn't really have a tight grasp of a lot of the arguments and issues, and so they would not be as persuasive. But I mean, have the courage to speak out for your freedom, have the courage to go out and protest if there's something which you want to protest on, and it doesn't matter if the government's videotaping it. The government can take the videotapes and put them where the sun doesn't shine. People need not to be intimidated by the government. I mean, government is perilous, but people need to hold the ground. And it's been frustrating to me. There are folks I've known for years, and I've seen how they've kind of rolled over for the post 9/11 abuses. And there's so many people who should know better. There's so many people who know the lessons of history and have seen what has happened in other countries when governments would be setting the same kind of precedents. Because, you know, what Bush and his team and what the media tell you to do is look at each abuse in isolation as a single incident. But, you know, this is a trend line. And things, you know, it's sort of like dominoes falling, you know. News media and the White House says, well, don't worry, that's only one domino. Yet how many others is it knocking down? So have the courage to speak out. It certainly helps to buy books. You know, people ask me, what can people do? I say, buy books. You know, that's the first step. There are some good groups out there, like Future Freedom Foundation, that's kept the flag high. some of the liberal left groups. I wish I had a better answer on that, because I'm not satisfied with the answer either. So. Okay. Yeah.
Ed Elmer from San Antonio, Texas. I just wanted to offer a historical example for how badly torture can backfire for a powerful regime. My example is a relatively harmless Middle Eastern subversive who ran afoul of his government and probably would still be unknown except that the government publicly tortured him to death. You've probably heard of this subversive. His name was Jesus Christ.
That's a good point, yeah. There's you know, one other example on the torture. I mean, folks say, well, it wasn't that many people, so on and so forth. But from one perspective, I mean, torture has cost the lives of 500,000 people in the last few years.
He didn't care.
Because some of the key evidence that the Bush administration got for invading Iraq came from torture. And there was one guy especially who was the key person for providing a link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. I think I've got that detail right. But
Al-Libi.
It was torture, and this guy had the wonderful confession, and that helped buttress the U.S. going to war against Iraq. And it later turned out that it was total BS. The government should have known it. And now we've got thousands of dead Americans. We've got tens of thousands of maimed Americans. We've got hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqis, thanks in part to torture. So it's a real pleasure to speak to such a fine audience, and I appreciate the chance to catch y'all here.
All right, everybody. That was the great libertarian reporter and author James Bovard speaking at the Future Freedom Foundation conference, Restoring the Republic in Reston, Virginia, just a few weeks ago. If you go to antiwar.com and click on Last 7 Days in that little section there and click on Tuesday, you'll find this as the spotlight article. And I will put up a link at thestressblog.com. James Bovard, of course, the author of Freedom in Chains, Shakedown, Feeling Your Pain, Terrorism and Tyranny, The Bush Betrayal, and his masterpiece, Attention Deficit Democracy, from the Future Freedom Foundation, James Bovard. His website is jamesbovard.com. And what a killer speech. And, of course, he did get that right in that last segment where he questioned his facts. Wait, did I get that right? Yes, he did get that right. They tortured Al-Libi into saying that Saddam Hussein trained Al-Qaeda on how to hijack planes and a bunch of other stuff. That was pure lies. You can read all about it. It's called Case Closed in the Weekly Standard. Pure lies. And so that's it for Anti-War Radio today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'll try to line up a good show for you tomorrow, 11 to 1 every day here in Austin, Texas, Chaos Radio 92.7, 95.9 FM.
have a line or don't stop. Woo! Come on, just get on the mic with the tick and the tack.
Come on, I'll bring you to the fucking rim like rim. I'm walking down your block and you say that's him. There goes the guy with the funky sound. The BC boys, you know we're gonna get down. Because I got the flow where I grab my dick and say,
oh my god,
that's the funky shit. So I'm gonna pass the mic and cause a panic. The original nasal kid is doing damage.
Everybody took the chain to the hot street station. Doing homework on the train. What a fucking situation. On the way back up here in battle days. Through the underground, underneath the sky space. It's like home world battles on the Zulu Beat show. It's cool when Divas visit me. That's one you should know. Enough of that. Just want to give some respect to SCA. Grab the mic and Marbell. You know,
it was a problem for the freedom fight. If that's a praise to the world, then I will feel